All right, here we are. Welcome, everyone. This is the...
It's a session of the council.
It's the afternoon.
This is February 12th already, in the afternoon. Session of the Portland City Council. We're now in session. Carla, could you please call the roll? Thanks.
Yes. Fritz.
Here.
Hardesty.
Here.
Udaly.
Here.
Wheeler.
Here. Now we'll hear from legal counsel on the rules of order and decorum. You can abbreviate if you want.
Okay. Good afternoon and welcome to the Portland City Council. The City Council represents all Portlanders and meets to do the city's business. The presiding officer preserves order and decorum during City Council meetings so everyone can feel welcome, comfortable, respected, and safe. We are not going to talk about participation as there is no testimony being taken today. If you are in the audience and would like to show your support for something that is said, please feel free to do a thumbs up. If you want to express you do not support something, please feel free to do a thumbs down. Please remain seated in council chambers unless entering or exiting. If you are filming the proceedings, please do not use bright lights or disrupt the meeting. Disruptive conduct such as shouting or interrupting testimony or council deliberations will not be allowed. If there are disruptions, a warning will be given that further disruption may result in the person being ejected for the remainder of the meeting. After being ejected, a person who fails to leave the meeting is subject to arrest for trespass. Thank you for helping keep your fellow Portlanders welcome, comfortable, respected, and safe.
Just the one. Sure. Item 143, amend the comprehensive plan, comprehensive plan map, zoning map, and Title 33, planning and zoning, to revise the single dwelling residential designations and base zones.
Very good. And is this the, I'm supposed to read this whole script today, is that correct? All right, very good. Colleagues, today we continue our work on the residential infill project. Before we begin, I want to announce that I own property in a residential zone. Properties in all residential zones could be impacted by the residential infill project. I have no plans and no intent to redevelop or change the use of my property. However, out of an abundance of caution, I'm disclosing this as a potential conflict of interest. Do other commissioners have any conflicts they would like to raise? Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. I don't believe I have a conflict. I'm a renter in the city of Portland, but just for the sake of, who knows, maybe one day I'll own something. I will declare a potential conflict of interest.
Hope springs eternal. Commissioner Fritz.
In the olden days, the rule was unless you were personally more impacted than everybody else in the same category, that you did not have a potential conflict of interest, but that has recently been changed by the courts. So I live in the city of Portland. I own property in the city of Portland.
So far, these are very, very boring conflicts.
I know. I may have a conflict of interest.
Very good. Commissioner Udaly.
I live in the city of Portland, and I am also a renter. And thank you for explaining that, because it did seem absurd to me that I would have to declare a conflict of interest, but I guess there's a state law that we're trying to
safe than sorry
abide by, yes.
It's a good thing you live here, otherwise you'd have a bigger problem.
Yes, right.
Next up, as a recap of where we are
before, yeah,
on the project. On January 29th, the council gave direction to BPS, the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability staff, about concepts for four technical amendments to the residential infill project. And today we're going to continue that process. We're going to hear from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability staff about additional amendment concepts that my fellow commissioners and I have heard from the public and have asked staff to further explore. I want to thank the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability staff, the Housing Bureau staff, and our legal counsel for their diligence in their review of these concepts to strengthen the residential infill project and to bring it across the finish line as quickly as possible. I'm calling on my colleagues to be judicious as we evaluate concepts today in order to narrow the scope of work for what is truly needed and what is possible for the residential infill project's final adoption. People can find summary of the amendment concepts posted on the residential infill project landing page on the Bureau of Planning Sustainability's website, or read along with the hard copies provided for those who are here today. The specific code language to reflect the concepts will be posted on the residential infill project webpage on March 5th. Council will then return on March 12th at 2 p.m. time certain here at City Hall to consider and vote on specific amendment language to the residential infill project. The record will reopen at the end of today's hearing and will remain open until the close of the public hearing on March 12th. When the record reopens, you can submit testimony about the amendments via MAP app, provide oral testimony at the March 12th council hearing, or mail testimony to the Portland City Council. As a reminder, the record has been closed since January 17th at 5 p.m. If you submitted letters or emails to members of the council when the record was closed, it is not considered part of the record. I encourage you to resubmit that testimony when the record is reopened at the end of today's hearing. Now I'll turn this over to the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability staff, Sandra Wood and Morgan Tracy, to walk us through the concepts for amendments. Good afternoon. Thank you for being here.
Good afternoon. It's good to see you again.
Likewise.
Likewise, thank you.
So I'm Morgan Tracy, project manager for the residential infill project, and joining me today is Sandra Wood, the co-development manager at the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and Joe Zender, chief planner. We are back for part two of your review of potential amendment concepts to the residential infill project. Like our last work session on January 29th, we will present each amendment concept and then ask, by the way of straw polls, for your general level of support. Staff will then go and invest the time and resources necessary to further develop these concepts into full-fledged amendments. Oops. Forgot to do that part. That's better. So there are 13 potential amendments to review this time around. For the folks watching at home, a description of these amendment ideas is available on the document section of our project website, which is shown on the slide there. Our first amendment for your review today relates to infrastructure. The idea behind this amendment is to limit lots without a curb to one or two units instead of allowing three or four. For context, there are about 116,000 lots in RIP zones that are large enough for a triplex or fourplex. About 8,000 of those lots are located within the Z overlay zone. These are lots that are constrained by natural resources or hazards and are therefore ineligible for three or more units. Additionally, there are about 1,600 lots that are on gravel streets, which are shown in red on this map, as well as 15,000 or so that are on under-improved streets, which are streets without a formal curb, and these are shown in yellow. The infrastructure bureaus have expressed that getting the remaining improvements constructed on unimproved and even under-improved streets can be very costly. Some of these costs may be due to the cost to relocate utility lines or convey stormwater to an improved discharge point. Even just engineering design for a small segment of street frontage is not so straightforward. So this cost obviously is passed on to the home buyer. The Planning Commission, in its recommendation, chose to apply a standard that streets had to be paved slash maintained in order to allow triplexes and fourplexes, which would ensure adequate mobility. The infrastructure bureaus are looking beyond just the street condition, including addressing stormwater. They determined that the presence of a curb or an otherwise accepted alternate design served as a reasonable indication of when required additional improvement could be justified and readily absorbed into the cost of development. This more conservative approach reduces the pool of eligible lots where three or more units would be allowed to around 90,000 or 77% of the total. Because House Bill 2001 does not give discretion on where houses and duplexes are allowed, this proposed restriction would only apply to three or more units. I'll leave it for you for discussion.
All right. Questions? Very good. Commissioner Udaly, do you have a question?
I don't have a question. I just have a comment to share with my colleagues. So I understand BPS and PBOT staff's concerns about supporting development on unimproved streets. However, I want to ensure that we're not excluding large parts of neighborhoods, many of which have not benefited from adequate city infrastructure investments. I don't want to exclude them from denser development. RIP's density allows for vibrant, walkable communities, something that should be available across the whole city. I've directed staff at PBOT to explore allowing the LTIC to be used to accomplish the goals of this concept and honor the requests made by the Cully Association of Neighbors, Verde, Habitat for Humanity, and NEA. Moving forward, I'd like for BPS to continue working with my office as we prepare to bring forward final amendment language that meets our equity, climate, and planning goals.
Commissioner Fritz.
I think I appreciate those sentiments, Commissioner Uday, and I think that this amendment actually helps us and it provides an incentive to do those for the developers to do the improvements as they move along. The Water Bureau, and I know Environmental Services, is really concerned with the question of who would bear the cost of making the public improvements. As we know with the Capital Highway Improvement Project, one of the main expenses is the stormwater management plan, as well as the paving and the other improvements. So I think this is a very reasonable way to be able to move forward with more attention to trying to focus density in those more walkable, livable neighborhoods where you can safely access where you need to go.
Commissioner Hersey. Well, first of all, I appreciate the intention of this concept, and I'm sure we agree that we need to make sure that housing is accompanied by whatever needed infrastructure investments there are, as Commissioner Udaly indicated. I'm not clear yet that the number of units on this site is necessarily the right approach at this particular junction, but I will give the thumbs up and ask the BPS staff work with the Infrastructure Bureau staffs to ensure that our policy is very clear regarding how and when infrastructure improvements are provided within the building permit application. So I think there's some good work yet to be done on this, and I support the basic concept.
Oh, in case it wasn't clear, I also support it.
Yes, I think I understand what the concerns are that the Cully community has raised and some other groups have raised. But again, I don't know that there's a magic number. And so I'm not bought in that, you know, three is the ideal number. Maybe it's four. I don't know, right? So I look forward to you doing a little bit more work and helping us kind of figure out if there is a magic number, because I absolutely agree. I don't think we should not develop in places that we've lacked the infrastructure, because it's not the community's fault they don't have the infrastructure. It is our fault that we don't have that infrastructure.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions from you of us before?
Nope.
Or do you have clarity on
no,
that?
No, I think that's clear.
Good. All right, good. Yep. Thank
so
you.
So we'll move forward on developing something more specific that works for as the bureaus.
Just a recommendation of what you think the best approach would be.
Yeah.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. So the next amendment is number six, and this has to do with deeper affordability bonuses. So moving off of infrastructure and talking about the price point of the units provided. As you probably recall, residential infill project already includes a modest Florida area ratio bonus for creating one moderately affordable unit at 80% MFI. But you heard a lot of testimony from the public that we should go deeper than what the Planning Commission recommended. So as a reminder, this slide shows the affordability, the rents for different units, and 80% MFI is a family of four earning $70,000. And that translates to a monthly rent for a three-bedroom unit equaling to $1,829 a month. So what this amendment would do is provide incentives for going below that to 60% income levels, which is the column that's highlighted, which means a family of four earning $53,000. This next slide shows several things. There's a lot of things on that slide, but to focus on today is the bottom callout already shows the affordability bonus that's already built into the proposal. So that's on the table right now. The top callout shows the concept for the deeper affordability bonus. So what this concept does is based on the testimony we received, or you received about calling for deeper affordability, it allows for four, five, or six units in a building that's built to 1.2 FAR and requires that at least half of those units be capped at incomes at 60% MFI for rental. In addition, it requires that a second unit be visitable as opposed to just one. So what this amendment does, it guarantees affordable units, and because it has a higher FAR, it allows for more family-friendly units. Also on this slide, you'll notice that the 1.2 FAR cap is smaller than what's currently allowed under the zoning code, which is that fifth house from the right. So the zoning code allows for 1.35 FAR right now, and this would set a maximum of 1.2.
So question, is yes. there a difference in the height?
There is a proposed additional 5-foot increase for the deeper affordability bonus.
And what so would then be the maximum height?
From 30 to 35 feet.
And in the R2.5 zone, there's already a 35-foot height limit.
And in R507?
30.
Some questions?
Commissioner Daly?
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. I appreciate the BPS staff has responded to advocates and my office's office push for greater FAR for deeply affordable development. This is going to allow nonprofit and for-profit developers to build affordable housing in some of the city's most resource-rich neighborhoods. It's very important to me that we support family-sized affordable housing, so I'm glad to see that that's a possibility there. In their letter, Anti-Displacement PDX asked us for this bonus as well as CET and SDC waivers and property tax exemptions, so I'm happy to see this progress on their request. ADPDX also asked us to explore a fee in lieu for the deeper affordability bonus, focusing funds on affordable infill development and generating revenue from underdevelopment to build more affordable housing. So I would like to ask BPS to look into these ideas further and meet with my staff as the amendment develops before it comes back to council.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. I guess for me, I'm concerned about us taking this route. From the beginning, I was told that this was not an affordable housing program, that RIP was about creating middle housing. And for the last year we've been having this conversation, we've been very clear about that this project, I'm concerned, quite frankly, that it's not enough units for CDCs to actually be able to, unless they have a block, that they are going to be able to get the return on the investment. I'm very concerned that we're trying to take a model that was not intended to provide affordable housing and squeeze affordable housing into it. The way we do it now is if you've got 40 units and four of them would have to be affordable based on our current criteria, I just don't know what we expect, how we expect to get a good mix of affordable housing if we're going to be doing it one house at a time, right? None of us will live long enough to actually see that we've had an impact on housing at all income levels. So I actually believe that this is not consistent with what we said RIP was supposed to do. Trying to create an affordable housing bonus inside a program that was very specifically about middle income housing, I think does us a disservice. It promises something that we will not be able to deliver in our lifetime. And I'm much more interested in how do we make sure that we're building housing that people can afford to live in as compared to a couple here, a couple there. We need a lot more housing, and this is not going to get us to affordable housing or housing people can afford to live in. So I do not think this is a good amendment. I do not think this amendment should move forward.
Commissioner Fritz.
I appreciate that both of my colleagues, therein lies the rub, right? What are we trying to do here?
Yes.
And so we haven't really had a focused discussion on that for quite some time. I'm concerned about the size of units. I don't think we're really creating that middle housing if all we're creating is studio apartments. The housing needs analysis shows that we really don't need any more small studios and one bedrooms. What we're short of is three bedrooms and family housing. And so to the extent that this amendment would tend to lead to eight small units rather than two larger ones, I agree with Commissioner Hardesty. It's going to a laudable goal, but in the meantime, impacting the other goals, which is for middle housing.
Well, I'm going to make this interesting for all of you because we, again, have four members and we're going to split on this, and I'll let you decide how you would like to proceed as staff, since the purpose of this exercise isn't to vote. It's really just to give you some guidance in terms of how to spend your staff's limited bandwidth. And hearing some of the concerns that Commissioners Hardesty and Fritz have raised, maybe there's another path here. I want to say for my part, I'm very supportive of this approach. We heard this concept expressed by several community organizations, including affordable housing developers. And we also have a strong precedent in terms of adopting a similar amendment in Better Housing by Design. And personally, I think it's important to keep these, the Better Housing by Design NRIP in alignment. In my opinion, this concept offers a needed flexible approach for supporting developers who are being creative in building affordable, and I would use capital A, affordable housing throughout the city. While I'd like to see the concept define MFI at the lowest end of the income spectrum as possible, I also have to acknowledge that funding and financing options are limited and complicated for affordable housing development. Because of this, I do support the tiered approach, 60% MFI for 99 years for rental or 80% MFI for 10-year ownership units. This structure still allows housing providers to utilize the bonuses for lower-income households should they be able to do so, but preserves the most flexibility to enable them to create housing based on the resources that they actually have available. So I'll give a thumbs up to the concept. You've heard some of the concerns my colleagues have expressed, and I'll leave it up to you to use your wizardry to see if there isn't something you can do to address their concerns. Commissioner Udaly.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm a little confused by some of the comments that I've heard from my colleagues, so I just want to clarify. This bonus would allow for family-sized units. Mm-hmm. We saw that on the image. Affordable housing developers such as Habitat for Humanity have asked for this and said that they can build more housing with it. And other than waiving fees for these affordable housing developers, I don't believe there's a cost to the city. Am I wrong?
It's as the mayor said, the pro forma, if you look at the Joe Zender with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, all of these, both the 80% and the 60%, are going to take finance being brought by the nonprofit developer typically to deliver the unit.
And I mean, my stance on residential infill all along is, will it generate the number of units we need to see, and will it generate the kinds of units we need to see, which are more affordable units? So I have to respectfully disagree with Commissioner Hardesty that there's not a place in RIP for incentives for affordable units. I mean, it would just be a missed opportunity to not try to serve the needs of affordable housing developers and even some private developers. I actually heard from a constituent recently who's he and his father is a landlord and kind of small-time developers, been doing that for decades. So they own some cheap dirt. They're not spending $250,000 on an empty lot, and they're committed to affordable housing, and they thought that this incentive wouldn't be available to private developers, which I understand it is. It's just we don't think many of them will take advantage of it.
Mm-hmm.
But once again, I've said this before, there are a lot of people in our community that want to help with this crisis. Why would we prevent them from trying to do that? And as to how many units this bonus will ultimately generate, one is better than zero. So I will fight for this.
So perhaps when we return, we can share some more of that pro forma information and show how the economics of this works out.
Commissioner Hardesty.
I would appreciate that, because after 12 years on the Board of Human Solutions, who builds affordable housing for very low-income families, I know what it takes for nonprofits to actually put a funding package together. And with few exceptions, I think it's a little challenging when you're talking about such few units because of how the financing works. There may be some nonprofits that that have the capability to do that, but should we develop policy based on what a couple of nonprofits have the ability to do, or should we be consistent in developing policy that actually meets the goals that we've laid out? Right, that is the question that's in front of us, and quite frankly, those nonprofits that can do it will do it now, with or without RIP, because they have that opportunity. So I don't see any reason why something that has been designed for middle-income families would now be shifted so that there are all these options. I think the community needs certainty, and the more we say, well, maybe you'll do this, maybe you'll do that, maybe we could do that, we have all these options, I think the more the community gets crazed because there's no certainty about where we're moving, how we're moving, and what the process is for that.
Commissioner Fritz.
So I believe all of the amendments that we're going to discuss today have been requested by constituents, and this commentary is really evidence that I hope that we'll take testimony on all of them, whether staff needs to do any more work or not. So far, the public's had 2 minutes to testify on this entire package, each person. You know, we've been doing it for, it seems like, about 1,000 years, but I'm sure it seems like 2,000 years to staff. But the public hasn't really had much opportunity to weigh in, so I do hope that I'm looking forward to robust and interesting information, and as the mayor says, people can send in testimony whether they've submitted it before or not, and the more that people can send them to our offices ahead of time, we can read the more detailed analysis and maybe spend more time listening to the public next time, and you know, not have to have a whole lot of staff presentation.
Yeah, and then let me ask a question of legal counsel. If you don't have the answer right away, that's fine. But if somebody has inadvertently submitted testimony in the interim while the record is technically closed, we're going to reopen the record. Is there no way to consider that testimony even though it was submitted during the time that the record was closed? The legal counsel.
So the record will be opening today. So anybody can submit that testimony into the record. So if your neighbor submitted something, and I mean, you if you received a pile of testimony and you want that in the record, you could also submit it into the record. It's
terrific.
Just that while the record is closed,
so it will not be excluded, provided that we read it, we bring it back into the record.
Correct. And you might make check with staff to make sure how they want that to come into the record.
Do you have thoughts on that, since I'm on the subject?
So typically the testimony we've received has gone through Carla's office, and then she forwards that to us, and we'll upload it into the MAP app.
Okay.
So mailed testimony is typically sent to her. And other testimony that the public wants to submit through the MAP app online, they can do that as well.
Great. Terrific.
I just say for myself personally, I find the email directly to me so that I can respond directly to the email rather than going to the MAP app and trying to figure out how to then respond. That just works better for me.
Great. Carla?
So you want us, all the testimony that we've received, to go ahead and put it into the record then in between time?
Unless somebody submits it, no. I mean, if you've received things during that period of time, unless it's resubmitted while the record is reopened, no.
They need to resubmit it?
Yes.
Okay.
But we can resubmit it.
Yes.
Good. Correct. All right.
If a piece of testimony just went to one commissioner, it didn't go to the council as a whole, and it's not, it wouldn't be. It's a testimony anyway.
Great.
So if you're just corresponding
But individually, we could reintroduce it to the record.
Correct.
Okay, I just needed clarification. I'm sorry to digress, but I was curious about that since it got raised.
Yeah. So closing up on this amendment, it sounds like we have it split, though. We will go work on it. Our goal would be to come with, for our next meeting, with an amendment, because we know the public's going to want to testify about this. They have testified about this and asked for this. So what we're trying to do is come up with a concept that we can move forward with, and then you can debate it and people can testify. If we don't add it as an amendment, then it's difficult for people to organize around it.
I want to be clear, we're not killing amendments today. So even if we...
Not any?
The question is, what do we want you to work on in terms of bringing back fully refined amendments? Now, it may be that in later public testimony, people either raise new concepts or they say, hey, you guys took a pass on Amendment X, and if there's overwhelming interest in having us go back and take a look at that, then we certainly can do that at a later date.
Yeah.
So, and I think an important piece of information is that we're preparing the full sort of text of the amendment so that when you have your hearing on it, you can keep moving forward through the legislative process. If we don't have that sort of full text that the public can see, we'll have to pause, come back again, and provide that text and have another hearing on it since we haven't had it.
Yeah, I just want to acknowledge you can't do a full workup on every single amendment that's been submitted. That's right. So today is really to cull your work. But I just want to be clear for the public hearing, if
there
they're
may
saying,
be more.
Wow, you guys aren't going to do further work on something that's really important to me. I want to understand, have people understand that when we do open this up for public testimony, there may be other amendments that we choose to revisit based on that testimony.
And Mayor, is it safe to say that after we have passed RIP, we still have the opportunity to make changes down the road if we, as we're monitoring and we're seeing that, you know, maybe we should have done X and we didn't think about this and now that it's being implemented, we will always have that option. Is that correct?
Staff?
That's correct.
So
it'll be another legislative process.
That's correct
it's another
to a certain extent. I mean, if
say a little more about that.
Right. So if we allow for an I'm going to ask our city attorney's desk. If we allow for four plexes on all lots and later we decide, no, it should be three plexes, we can't roll back.
You cannot roll that back.
Correct.
But you can roll up.
Yes. Yes, you can roll up, but not back.
Well, that's good to know because I don't think we actually talked about eight units on a property before. Have we?
No, and that's not part of this concept either.
Okay.
Yeah, we're talking about six in this concept. And speaking to what you had said earlier, I think we struggle with this on our code team of, do we put this in the code knowing that it's not going to be used very often?
Mm-hmm.
That's why our code is this big. And so it might not be the primary reason for the residential infill project, but because we heard so loud and clear from nonprofit developers and CDCs, and that's what the 1.2 FAR came to, if we put it in there, what's the harm is the other side of that, right? What's the harm of putting in there? If someone could use it once or twice, like Commissioner Udaley said, one unit is better than zero, two units is better than zero. So we struggle with that too, so I can understand where you're coming from.
So I appreciate that, right? Because for me, I just did not want to falsely raise expectations that somehow after we passed this, we would see all kind of housing that people could afford to live. Showing up all over the city of Portland, right? And so thank you for that. No, that helps me feel more comfortable because I really did not want to raise expectations that this was going to be the solution. I mean, because we've said that over and over again, this is not the solution.
It's not the affordable housing solution. It's just a tool that nonprofits could use. And 43% of the city, right? That's another part of this is the map of all the yellow and how much single dwelling zone we have. So it opens up opportunities in more areas.
Historic resource.
Moving on.
If I could just add one more thing, one more thought to this. I appreciate the dialogue sure. When the Supreme Court ruled, I think in 1917, that it was unconstitutional to deny the sale of real estate to someone based on race, we saw cities across the country implement zoning codes. And zoning codes became a proxy, income became a proxy for race. And so I do think that there's an important place in this conversation for affordable housing. We want more people of all income levels to have more choices about where they live in our city. And so to me, this is an essential part of the conversation. Thanks.
Thank you.
Historic resource demo.
So this amendment concept would add a restriction where a historic resource is demolished without prior city council approval. Because council approval is already a requirement in historic districts, this primarily affects sites in conservation districts. There are about 1,750 such conservation sites in RIP zones. The restriction, similar to the one recently added to the Better Housing by Design project, limits the redevelopment options to a house or duplex when the resource has been demolished without council approval.
And this is to be consistent with Better Housing by Design?
That's correct.
Mayor?
Commissioner Udaly.
Yeah. So I would support staff looking into this concept and bringing back an amendment for us to consider. I support steps we can take to promote internal conversions and preserve quality older existing homes. I think I share concern with Commissioner Fritz and other community members that we may see an uptick in demolitions due to RIP, and I understand that some of the constraints we've put on the size of buildings that can go on these lots are designed to mitigate that, but I think this is another way we could potentially mitigate or encourage creative reuse of existing buildings.
Commissioner Hurst.
Thank you, Mayor. I just think this is, because it's consistent with Better Housing by Design, it makes sense for us to have a amendment to review around that.
Great. And I'll give this what I'll call a courtesy thumbs up. I'd like to encourage developers and housing advocates to give us more information on this and to testify early on this concept. I'm somewhat skeptical about whether this is really needed or strategic within the confines of residential infill, but I'd like to hear more. I'd like to hear more on this.
Okay, thank you. So moving on to the concept for amendment number 8. As you know, the Planning and Sustainability Commission recommended that the city not require parking for single dwelling zones. So part of that is that they also recommended that garages not be allowed on the fronts of narrow houses. Their primary reasons for disallowing garages was to preserve the on-street parking on right in front of the properties and to preserve space for street trees. This amendment would reverse that and would allow at least a 12-foot garage on all houses.
So
Commissioner Fritz.
I worked on the so-called snout house regulations when I was on the Planning Commission in the 1990s. It seems to me that those are old skinny lot houses that don't comply with the current zoning code, because I think this was
the picture on the left.
Yes, well, several of those you can't. The front door is set back, and there isn't a porch. So, you know, I'm continue to be concerned about having places for people to recharge their electric vehicles, and most lots in Portland don't have access from a alley. So, changing from the code as it is today, which is working well and has resulted in development that does fit in with neighborhoods, I support this amendment because I think it's needed, and that the current status quo is not causing problems.
And I do want to clarify that there's two standards today. Here's where I get very wonky. There's one standard for the old historically padded lots, which do allow a 12-foot garage currently. And there's a different standard for new narrow lots that were created after 2002. Okay. And that's just because of the way the legislation worked out at the time. So one of the points of agreement we had on our stakeholder advisory committee was to, let's not have two standards for the same size lots, let's have one set of standards. And the way the Planning Commission landed was one set of standard not allowing the garage.
Okay, but their recommendation was before Senate Bill 534 passed, and so we're going to potentially have a lot more skinny lot developments, and so I think we could possibly do both and still allow a single garage so that people can park their electric cars.
Yeah, and it doesn't change the fact that if you have 25-foot wide lots and a garage, that an on-street parking space is eliminated for that curb cut.
Right, but you can't, it's very difficult to plug in a vehicle parked at the curb.
Yes.
Commissioner Udaly.
Thank you, Mayor. Well, I agree with Commissioner Fritz that we do need to solve the problem of charging our lack of infrastructure for electric vehicles. I don't agree that that means every home needs to have a driveway or a 12-foot garage. This conflicts with our city's transportation policy and climate goals. Garages reduce living space and inhibit active front yards. They increase the cost of housing while reducing available street parking. And for those reasons, I cannot support this concept.
Commissioner Hardesty?
Thank you. I also do not support this concept. It is inconsistent with the vision that we have that we're moving forward to. I think that we could talk about charging community charging stations for those fortunate enough to be able to buy electric cars. Most of the folks in my neighborhood, we're a long way from that. But I think if there's a concern about people having vehicle charging stations, what a great opportunity for community members to create business opportunities to do just that. So I don't support this at all, and I would not want you wasting your time trying to figure out how to add garages back.
Well, it would just be keeping the current code, so I'm not asking them to do any work on it either.
Then we're in agreement. I don't think you should move forward.
Don't do anything.
Okay. So amendments, concepts number 9 and number 10 are similar in that they each propose an affordability mandate for certain types of housing. The first requires that when a unit that has been renting at a certain affordability level is redeveloped, at least one of the new units be available at that income level. The second specifies that in order to develop 3 or more units, one of the units must be affordable at 60% MFI. The challenge in each of these proposals beyond their economic feasibility is the state preemption on rent control and mandatory inclusionary zoning. In these cases, mandated affordability requirements are only applicable to buildings with 20 or more units. Cities can offer incentive packages in the form of bonuses, like those described for Amendment Number 6, but cannot set affordability requirements for already authorized housing types. And that's really the primary challenge with these proposals.
So Commissioner Udaly pointed out this morning about the displacement that's happened in Lentz, of homeowners and of renters. And my reading of these requests that were made from the community are to address that issue. I disagree with I don't think this is inclusionary zoning. It's an incentive to allow, we don't have to allow triplexes. We could incent providing at least one affordable unit by allowing a triplex where we wouldn't otherwise.
Commissioner Daly.
I love this idea. I love the intent of it to protect below market rents in redevelopment situations. But I guess I share the concern that it could be seen as a taking or a form of rent control and that just wouldn't be allowed at the state. So if that's not the case, I would support it. If it is the case, then let's go lobby Salem.
Well, especially 10, if you frame it as an incentive to allow 3 units, then it's not inclusionary zoning.
My concern with this is completely based on advice from legal counsel, and I'm concerned that this would qualify as a required affordability, which philosophically I'm not opposed to, but in the context of state statute, I'm opposed to it if it calls into question the legality of RIP. And I would not want staff to work on a concept that legal counsel is advising as strongly is contrary to state statute. I think that would be a mistake, be building a poison pill into the overall program. If we want to take it up later separately, I'm okay with that. But I'd be very reluctant to take that up in the context of the whole body of RIP. And that's what legal counsel is advising us, unless somebody has countervailing evidence.
Okay.
So just so I understand, we would be restricting a developer who, if they didn't have to take down a house that was affordable at 80 MFI, or below, they would be able to build one thing. But if they did take down a house that was currently affordable at 80% MFI, they would be restricted. Is that?
Yeah, the proposed amendment language is not totally clear. It's still concept level, but the idea being sort of this no net loss of an affordable, naturally occurring affordable unit, which roughly translates to rent control.
Right.
Which were preempted from exercising.
Yeah. Oh,
good in concept, but right, challenging to implement. So I think a countervailing concern would be if we set the limit on triplexes, if we took that angle, then we are essentially making the case to build nothing but duplexes, because getting to a triplex makes it less feasible than building a duplex.
Right. Okay.
That's interesting.
Okay. So are you clear about where we're headed with that?
So I'm hearing that we don't pursue this one and we don't keep working on either 9 or 10, and we move on to number 11 today.
That's what I'm hearing.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
So number 11, this one is about limiting 3 or more units to the R2.5 zone. So as you know, the Planning and Sustainability Commission recommended allowing 4 units on most lots. This amendment would limit triplexes, fourplexes, and multiple ADUs to the sites that are zoned R2.5. This map on your screen shows the existing R2.5 zoning in the city. In the orange is what's already there, and in the purple is the rezones that are already included in the residential infill proposal. Together, they only account for 10% of the city's total single-family residential zones. Also, staff doesn't know whether this amendment is consistent with House Bill 2001, which calls for allowing housing types not duplexes, at least, not just by zone, but in areas zoned for residential units. So if we limited it to only one zone, we're not sure we'd be complying with the House bill.
Well, which you won't know until the end of this year when the rules come out. So we don't know what the definition of area is.
Correct.
So just looking at the map, there are in each quadrant of the city R2.5 zones, which could be potentially taken as such. I mean, the reason I believe this amendment was proposed is because in the comprehensive plan map in 2016, we considered where do we actually want more housing, and we have multiple policies in the comprehensive plan encouraging more development on corridors and places with good transit and good services, including sidewalks. And so that's what this would get to.
Commissioner Hurst.
So I guess why would we be limiting the number of units that we could build all around the city?
Because people will have to drive because they can't get to transit.
Drive, bike, walk, expand public transit, those kind of things, right? So I'm not feeling the need to limit where we build housing. And, you know, it's like there's a lot of areas that have built up, and after they build up, hopefully we put pressure enough on TriMet so that we're expanding public transit opportunities. But I just to just say it, when, you know, this particular zone is the only place we can do that, just doesn't make sense to me. So I would hope you not spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to make that work.
I don't support it either. My understanding is that it's in conflict with SB 2001 and density drives transit service. So to limit density because there isn't existing transit means that we may never see transit in those areas. And if I have anything to say about it, we're going to see a massively expanded public transit system. So I just wouldn't support this.
I also don't support it. I think it undercuts RIP and the entire purpose of RIP. And I'll just state again for the record, this is a longer-term vision for the city. And if we have to peg our long-term vision around the current status of public transit in our community, we're in a heap of trouble. And so I think we should both expand the opportunities for the diversity of housing and where that housing exists. And we should also encourage our partners who provide transit services to be a little bolder in their thinking about their vision for the future.
So colleagues, obviously I'm not surprised by any of these discussions. I will point out that the comprehensive plan directed the residential infill project to be done on centers and corridors, and it was expanded by the Planning Commission, Planning Sustainability Commission. There are multiple policies in the comprehensive plan that I will be very interested to see how findings will be written to support the essentially doing away with zoning in single-family zones.
Joe, what do you say to that? Because that's a strong argument. What do you say to that?
You know, I think there's a couple of tacks on this. If you remember the diagram we showed when we were looking at the deeper affordability, so we really have constructed between this project and Better Housing by Design and the work you previously did on the mixed-use zone, this kind of spectrum of intensity of development in the centers and corridors. That's where you have your mixed-use and your multifamily. What we're doing with residential infill is not so much increasing housing options in that 45% of our land source that is single family today. We believe we need to do that to take pressure off of the housing supply and housing cost. We believe that we've done that in a way that stays consistent with our infrastructure capacity. And still most of the development, most of the units are still in centers and corridors aligned with transit. So this is a general raising of the bar, not necessarily needed to meet 2035 growth projections, but for sure needed to get to our longer range objectives after that, both carbon and growth.
Thank you.
Great. So concept number 12 is related to the anti-displacement action strategy and its timing. This amendment calls for a delay on decisions related to the residential infill project until the city completes and funds a citywide anti-displacement strategy. This is misguided. As evidenced in the displacement risk analysis, RIP effectively reduces redevelopment pressure and lowers the risk of displacement in comparison to the status quo. So the map on this slide is showing that displacement risk is reduced pretty much throughout the city except for three exceptions in three neighborhoods. And in those three neighborhoods, that increase is relatively low. So RIP is part of the toolbox to address displacement. And you heard that in your testimony. There's a high cost of not doing things today with RIP.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. I think what we also heard, and I've certainly talked to a lot of members of the Anti-Displacement Committee, is that they do not want us to slow down. If we slow down, they have a bigger fear of us slowing down than they do of us moving forward, passing RIP, and then making a commitment to ensure that the Oversight Committee is as robust as possible. I talked to the members because I also, if you may remember when you were presenting, I was pushing you, get that committee up. And so I went and double checked, and they agreed that they just were not ready to do the work they needed to do yet. They had internal work that those organizations needed to do to be prepared to be part of this work group. And so I agree with your assessment that this is not necessary because there's no need to delay the process when the folks that are on the committee agree that it has to move forward and they're willing to go along with this process in this timeline.
Commissioner Daly.
Yeah, I mean, everyone knows that I would have preferred that we had this work done to move forward side by side with RIP, but we work closely with community, including ADPDX, and they have strongly signaled to us that they do not want this to hold up RIP. And we've also heard from representatives of at least one of the neighborhoods that may be likely to see increased displacement, that they also don't want to hold up the process. They don't want their neighborhoods exempted. They want us to move forward, and of course they want us to also hustle on the anti-displacement plan. So I don't support this item.
So the map shows that, once again, the city of Portland will be disproportionately impacting low-income communities and communities of color.
So I disagree with the preferred sequence that's requested here. I want to note that this seems counter to a lot of testimony we received, including from anti-displacement advocates who tell us to move forward. And I want to acknowledge that this is not something we're putting on the sideline or a back burner. BPS is working with other bureaus, my staffs, the commissioners, and community partners to institutionalize a citywide cross-bureau approach to displacement. And we even began that funding through last year's budget. And I believe it was Commissioner Udaly who'd put some packages together through the Office of Community and Civic Life to work with BPS and the Housing Bureau and others. We have seen through BPS's analysis that the RIP is a type of anti-displacement solution that overall improves the status quo. While we also acknowledge that in three neighborhoods, I believe is Brentwood, Darlington, Montevilla, east of 82nd, and Lentz, there is in fact some additional displacement of communities of color. And that is something we are concerned about, and we do need to continue to address that. I also don't want to overstate it. I believe it was 44 units of displacement over a 15-year period. And I have great confidence that we can address a problem of that scale. And I just want to say how much I appreciate our bureaus working together, Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, the Housing Bureau, Prosper Portland, working with community partners both to make sure that we have better data about forecasting how much and where that displacement is going to take place, and also focus on our capital planning going forward. So I believe we need to continue to institutionalize this practice and hold ourselves accountable. And therefore, I would not support slowing down the process to address this question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next amendment idea is number 13, and it has to do with a disincentive fee for demolition and or removal of trees. So it's calling for two things, adding a demo fee when a house is demolished and increasing fees for tree removal. Regarding the demolition fee, as you may recall, demolition fees were considered by council in 2015 when we were at a peak of the number of demolitions that the city was seeing. We were at about 400 houses being demolished at that time. It's considerably less now. And at the time, it was not pursued in part due to concerns that the cost of the fee, the disincentive, would just be passed on to the home buyer or renter when something is built in its place. Regarding the tree removal fees, our position is that these are more appropriately considered during the tree code work that BDS and the Urban Forestry Division of Parks is underway doing, and that it should be more comprehensive and not just for the three zones that we are talking about in residential infill.
Well, personally, I'll defer to your recommendation. This isn't the tree issue is one we will have to take up, and if you're saying take it up within Title 11, I have no dispute there, and I continue to have meetings with community partners on all sides of this issue around the tree issue. So I do look forward to having that conversation. It's one we need to have.
Same.
Yeah, I don't think we're
safe. I don't see why it needs to come up with an RIP.
Sounds good. Okay, we're getting there. Yeah. Number 14 relates to the system-wide impacts of the Senate Bill 534. As you recall, Senate Bill 534 was passed last year, which requires cities to approve development on substandard size platted lots. This request is an amendment that would require the city to evaluate the infrastructure capacity for an area if all the plats were to be fully built out. Under the amendment, if the city determined the full build out would exceed available capacity, then the city would restrict development. Senate Bill 534, however, requires the city to allow at least one dwelling unit on each platted lot, unless the city determines the lot cannot be adequately served. The determination of whether there is adequate infrastructure service is made at the time of development with each development permit. The development review process includes systems to check for availability and adequacy of infrastructure, which is checked at the building permit stage. So the issue here is that the bill basically limits our ability to restrict development on the condition of a future condition of adequacy of the services in that area.
So I'm really happy about this one. There's not a Bureau of Planning and Sustainability argument against it. In fact, there's no argument about it at all, other than that they need to find some more information. The Bureau of Environmental Services was not able to send me any documentation about their analysis of this issue in 2016 or for the residential infill project. And the reason I know this is an issue is because it's already been adjudicated at the Land Use Board of Appeals back in 1983, I believe it was, that there was a single lot that was going to be developed into two houses, but only the zoning was only for one. It was in a skinny lot area. And there was a study done, the West Portland Park study in 1979, which I put into the record, which said that the area couldn't develop at the intensity that this house, that if it went area-wide, that this upzoning would have, because the interceptor, the sewer interceptor in Tryon Creek State Park would not manage it. So I think we're all asking, what is a sewer interceptor? It is a component of a sewer network that helps to control its flow. It receives the flow from trunk sewer lines and sometimes from stormwater runoff, and it directs it to the wastewater treatment plant. It is amongst the larger lines of a sewer system. So this particular interceptor is located in Tryon Creek State Park, and it goes to the Tryon Creek Wastewater Treatment Plant, not to the Columbia Boulevard one that we were talking about this morning. And so it would be practically impossible to get land use approval to dig up that interceptor and make it bigger. And therefore, we ought to be looking at area-wide what is the carrying capacity of the land, and that is a fundamental principle of planning. What's the carrying capacity? In this case, what's the carrying capacity of that sewer?
Yeah, so there's a couple responses to that. I think when we start talking about sewer interceptors, I get a little bit looking over my shoulder with our BES partners who might be able to help us explain some of the details of that. But I think the ultimate question comes down to state preemption. And while the reason we haven't couched this in terms of a good planning argument is because the Senate bill is not giving us a lot of options in that regard. So I just offer that.
Did you want to say something?
Do you want to add something?
Shannon Reynolds is the asset manager for BES.
Right, so our...
Shannon, could you introduce yourself for the record?
Sure. My name's Shannon Reynolds. I'm the ASM, Asset Systems Management Division Manager for BES. I manage... Can you hear me? Hear me okay?
Yeah,
so I manage a group of stormwater... hydraulic system analysis folks who produce updates of our system based on all sorts of assumptions that kind of, you know, determine the capacity of our system and the influences of that, of land use on our system. So in 2010, we updated an analysis in this area for the Tryon Creek interceptor. And we, based on new information and some diversions that were done out of that basin, currently don't see a capacity issue in Tryon Creek Interceptor for our sanitary flows. And using future development scenarios that we align with or that we receive from BPS, we start to see some capacity issues, but they're not as consequential as we once did maybe earlier on before that analysis was conducted.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you. And aren't systems development charges supposed to cover the cost of infrastructure improvements when somebody's developing a...
For utilities, you're buying into the current system. You're not buying new upgrades.
That's not my expertise.
Okay, no worry. Right, you're buying into the system for utilities, so whoever's providing the utilities will you get.
Yeah, so you're buying the right to access the current pipes.
Wait, next.
Hi, Elizabeth Reese-Cadigan, Systems Development Manager at BES. Commissioner Fritz is correct. With the utilities, BES and water, you're buying into the existing system.
But I'm assuming that the cost of SDCs is calculating what's the additional pressure being put on public resources, right? So it's calculated based on the totality of the impact you're going to have, right, either currently or into the future as development continues. Is that accurate?
Yes, we just use the past capital costs is the methodology we use, looks backwards at what we've already spent on the system, but there is a forward-looking element built into that methodology in terms of what our future capital program, our estimates are for that out 5 and 10 years.
Thank you. Very helpful.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Shannon, thank you, too.
So, any further discussion? Go ahead.
So I think for me, I would just say no at the moment. I especially we're talking like really skinny lots. I don't see us, if we're building a house on it because we're mandated by the state, I don't see that there's going to be a significant impact on the infrastructure for that. So I don't need any additional information on that.
Happy to defer to staff on that.
I guess,
yeah, I just,
I think sort of to add to this conversation a little bit, and forward thinking and beyond essentially residential infill, what this means for our infrastructure bureaus in terms of Senate Bill 534 is there's additional work to be done in terms of forecasting growth in those areas. So it's not an issue that's going to go away. It's just not going to be something that we can necessarily codify as part of this project.
So she has no time this month to do it, but at some point I'm going to have government relations and Elizabeth Edward review the record that we're presenting, because I'm hearing lots of opportunities for coordination with the state.
They were not interested in coordinating with us when they passed Senate Bill 534.
Right.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, yeah.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, that is true.
Okay. Yeah, and so what Morgan was saying about the preemption, I mean, that's basically what they did. And as Commissioner Fritz has mentioned before, we were not supportive of this Senate bill when it was going through as a city, correct?
Yes.
And so what we have now is basically a rule that says don't treat any pre-platted lot different than you would any other lot.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's what we're trying to codify and make sure it's clear.
Got it.
And we believe we have a fail-safe in the system, too, because at the building permit stage, they can still look at issues that emerge. So, but as far as the entitlement to build the lot, we're preempted at the state level.
I see.
And have the state rules been written yet?
There won't be state rules for this one.
There won't be.
Not
oh,
possible.
Lovely.
Correct. Yes. Yes. But as Joe says, like, imagine a lot coming in on a gravel road that doesn't have utilities, and they come in for a building permit. Our departments will be reviewing it and saying, where's the water line? There is no water line in front of here. You need to extend it at your own expense.
Good. Well, I am certainly looking forward to the discussion on this next one.
Oh, indeed.
And oh, the next one, number 15. That's mine. Yes. So this is a request that came in through testimony to change the zoning in an area in the Concordia neighborhood. It's shown on the map, so I won't give a description. The current zoning there is R5, and the request is that it go to R2.5. The area is a little unusual in that the lots are 4,000 square foot sites instead of the typical 5,000 square foot sites that we see in most of
Inner
Portland.
Can you just tell me historically why is that?
The whoever did the subdivision in the 20s decided that's what they wanted to sell. And so they subdivided it that way. So the issue that was raised in the testimony and why the 4,000 square feet in their view is a problem is that the minimum lot size for triplexes and fourplexes in the R5 zone is set at 4,500, which means that these lots would not be large enough for a triplex and fourplex. So this amendment request is to change it from R5 to R2.5. There are about 500 properties in this area. While we don't necessarily object to this rezoning, we have a question really about the timing and process. We're concerned that the property owners haven't been notified of this proposal, or they haven't been afforded the opportunity to testify at the Planning and Sustainability Commission. In this project for residential infill, as you know, we had, as in every project, people are trying to, the scope creep and so, and we were trying to keep this to let's fix the tool and we'll fix the map and work on the map later. So we feel like this rezoning could better be served with an area-specific project in
so
the future.
Would it be your intention then, if I'm hearing your it sounds like you're saying hold off, wait till there's an area specific planning exercise that's done, and you would come back to council with a map amendment. Is that what you're proposing?
I'm not proposing. That's on our immediate work plan. I'm just saying
But I am hearing you say yes. You would at least like to talk to the neighborhood before you do it, which strikes
Correct.
Me as eminently
yes.
sensible.
And there may be other lots in the city in this situation, so either we're doing an area-specific thing or we need to take a bigger look. It's not right to squeeze it into this
generation. Okay, so this isn't imminent. This could be 20 years out. It could be far. This is an area planning exercise that has not even been scoped at this point.
Correct.
Got it.
Or funded.
Okay. That's
say.
Helpful. Thank you. I yes. appreciate it. Commissioner Fritz?
Obviously, the staff and I, all three of them, and I and my staff have had multiple discussions about this, and the response on this one I agree with. I do think that there may be another project in the not-too-distant future that should look at this, because when I actually felt kind of chagrined that we didn't notice this area in the comprehensive plan process, because it's close in, it's got good transit, it looks like an ideal place to have more homes built. But I agree to defer it and do it in the next one.
Okay, so number 15 doesn't move forward. 16?
Number 16, Amendment 16 is calling for excluding triplexes and fourplexes from dead-end streets. This issue came up in your testimony. The Fire Bureau has reviewed this amendment and notes that the level of development that's authorized by residential infill doesn't rise to the level where two means of egress, are required, such as commercial developments that are taller than 30 feet, buildings larger than 60,000 square feet, and residential projects with more than 200 units. So by comparison, we're talking about 3,000 square foot triplexes and fourplexes, roughly about a 30 foot height. And for most of these streets, we're not going to get anywhere near 200 units. The building size and housing units for RIP are well below those thresholds and can be adequately addressed by the Fire Bureau requirements during the building permit review process.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. I just want to assure you, I've talked to the fire marshal and my fire chief, and those huge trucks can turn around on a dime. They are having no problems getting out of dead-end streets. They are not having any problems getting the fires that are on dead-end streets. So I'm not quite sure where the amendment came from, but it's certainly not an issue for a fire at all.
Yeah, this was my fault.
Oh.
Because there was some testimony, and I thought it was actually very compelling testimony, or at least I thought it warranted follow-up, because somebody had explained that they felt that being on a dead-end street, some of the increased density could potentially create a public safety or health hazard. And so I did ask that we look at this, and Commissioner Hardesty, your office was very, very helpful, as was the Fire Bureau, and I want to appreciate them. And it gave me an opportunity to learn from the city's experts on to what degree there are hazards on undeveloped streets, on streets that end in a dead end or a cul-de-sac, and how we actually respond to those. And I was very pleased to hear overwhelmingly that the residential infill project does not put residents or city personnel at greater risk. On this matter, there's really no higher expert that I could think of going to than the Fire Bureau leadership themselves, and their assessment is that this is not an issue, and therefore I would not support BPS staff continuing to propose an amendment to exclude these particular areas from RIP.
Well, if I might provide some historical perspective, this particular street was the subject of a lot of testimony during the comprehensive plan process. At that point, at that stage, the Fire Bureau did have concerns about adding more units on a long, long dead-end street. When we've already had a legislative process that has looked very specifically at an issue, to then obviously the new council didn't make that decision. So I feel like the infrastructure, if we're having capacity concerns on undeveloped or underdeveloped streets, it seems like the life safety issues inherent in a dead-end street would cause for at least allowing these neighbors to come and testify on this, although we've said that none of these thumbs up, thumbs down decision today mean that people can't testify on this at the next hearing.
That's right.
So I think my colleagues might find it helpful to hear the description of this particular street and why the neighbors remain concerned despite the assurances from the fire marshal.
I The testimony provided previously by one of the residents of the street did raise concerns for me, but I defer to Commissioner Hardesty and the Fire Bureau. I looked into the street specifically and don't believe that there are concerns that would warrant removing it from RIP.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll be very clear. I mean, if the Fire Bureau told me there was a life safety issue and we needed to exempt it, I'd exempt it in a heartbeat, but that's not what I'm hearing.
No.
Okay. And finally is amendment constant number 17 about front setbacks. So this amendment seeks to increase the front yard setbacks to match the setbacks of the adjacent lots. A version of this proposal was included in the proposed amendments to the Planning and Sustainability Commission. They heard a fair amount of testimony of it about it and debated it and ultimately recommended removing the proposal. Their main issues was that increasing the front yard decreases and the backyard setback if you want to get the same size house, and it's less flexible and could negatively impact the ability to retain trees, which are typically in the backyard also. For these reasons, we wouldn't support it and reintroducing it.
I don't hear any strong objections to that logic.
Okay, thank you.
To not bringing it back, it's overly prescriptive. Whatever you do on the front yard is going to have an impact on the backyard.
Yeah. And that was our last amendment concept. Yay!
All right. Well, thank you, team, for your work to develop these concept amendments. We appreciate it. I appreciate the thank you, Sam. I appreciate the dialogue in this public meeting with my colleagues. As always, it's very interesting. And I ask my colleagues to continue to keep this scope of work focused and disciplined so we can deliver a proposal that allows middle housing in our single dwelling zones. For the concepts that have been continued on, I wanted to direct DPS and my staff to continue working with our community partners, builders, and neighborhood associations. My office will continue to be reading and listening to all testimony that is submitted on the record. Council will return on March 12th. At 2 p.m., time certain here at City Hall to further act on amendment language to the residential infill project. The record is now open and will remain open until the close of the public hearing on March 12th. You can submit testimony about these amendments via the MAP app, provide oral testimony at the March Council hearing, or of course, you can mail testimony to City Council or email testimony to City Council, however you want to get it here. The hearing on March 12th is limited to 3 hours, and therefore Council may not be able to hear from everyone who attends. I encourage you to submit your written testimony in advance of that hearing to ensure that we consider your testimony before voting on the amendments. Anything else I have forgotten for the good of the record?
I just want to really appreciate all of you. I mean, the amount of work that you've put into this has been pretty phenomenal. The fact that you're still actually able to separate amendments just boggles the mind. So just thank you for the work you've done, the thoughtfulness that you've put into this process, and I greatly appreciate each and every one of you and look forward to us getting to the result. Thank you.
And on that, I believe we have complete agreement. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioners.
Thank you. Excellent. Thank you, Commissioner.
Are we about to adjourn? Or?
Yes, we're about to adjourn.
You're kidding me.
Not at all.
Okay. Well, I'll just want to quickly thank BPS staff for working tirelessly on this for years. Thank you, Joe, for always being willing to answer my many, many questions. And, of course, to Morgan Tracy and Sandra Wood. I also want to thank the community groups that have been paying close attention to this and helping hold Council accountable. In particular, thank you to the organizations that make up ADPDX, Living Cully, and Portland Neighbors Welcome. As we move on to the next step of drafting amendments for Council to consider and open the public record for testimony, I'll be evaluating the final proposal with a strong focus on racial justice, disability justice, and environmental justice. I strongly support creating more housing opportunity for everyone, and I look forward to our final conversation on this project.
Great. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
We are adjourned.
Oh, I thought we would have...